In 2017, the Libertarian Union was formed. Finally, the average Joe Libertarian could find a thriving community of independent podcasters and content providers, all in one convenient location. At Libertarian Union, we'll always have the latest news, interviews, discussions, and even movie reviews. With hundreds of episodes and more added all the time, you'll always find something fresh at LibertarianUnion.com.
Hello, friends. This is Patrick McFarlane here of the Liberty Weekly podcast, and we are doing our State of the Libertarian Union talk show for the month of August 2018. And with me are the members of the Libertarian Union. That is Daniel of the Actual Anarchy podcast. That is Thijs Vanderlinde of Gaius Libertatis, Nick Bacone of Sounds Like Liberty, and Stephen Clyde of the Peace and Liberty podcast. So I'm going to be handing it off to each one to just kind of talk about their show just very quickly and then tell what they've been up to for the last couple weeks here. So I'll start off with Daniel. How's it going, buddy?
Hey, it's going great. Thanks for having me on. This is a lot of fun meeting up with you guys once a month and hopefully more at some point in the future. I'm Daniel Elwood. I do the Actual Anarchy podcast and the Last Nighters podcast with my co-host Robert. And we just today released our episode on Office Space at actualanarchy.com/90. It'll come out tomorrow as the Last Nighters version, which is a normie-friendly version that doesn't have the anarchy stank in the name. LastNighters.com/33 and also on TheLaunchpadMedia.com. It's the Monday show. Nick also has a show on there, so if you don't mind, I can just pass it over to Nick. And what have you been working on lately?
Well, I've been blogging on the Sounds Like Liberty podcast.com, which today has just been going on about the Liberty quality, but I host the show with my wife Lizzie. And we talk about liberty through a music lens and talk to other libertarians about music and try to build camaraderie and community. Need more libertarian community. Since Thijs is on the screen, why doesn't he tell us what he's up to?
Yeah, okay. So, the name of my project right now is Gaius Libertatis. So it's sort of inspired by Patrick's work, but in a European perspective on the legal side. And I've currently recorded 2 out of 3 episodes I'm planning to do with my launch. So if all goes well, I might be able to launch next week, but I'm not 100% sure. And I hope to join soon.
And Stephen Clyde, what's up? Well, hold on a sec. Thijs, why don't you tell everyone your URL? Send them somewhere.
Oh, yeah. So, it's gaiuslib.com is my WordPress website, and I also have a Facebook page and a couple other social media pages where I can all be found on through Gaius Libertatis. So if you search that, you should be able to find me.
Okay. And the link should be in the description for this YouTube video right now, so we got that. Stephen, what's up, buddy? How's it going?
What's up, y'all? I've been doing okay. I've been working on a lot of projects right now. I recently started writing my third book. I'm writing 3 books right now. The most recent one, I hope that it's going to be a shorter one, so I hope to publish it in a few months. It's going to be called The Case for Corporations. Essentially, Robert Hessen wrote a book in the 70s called In Defense of the Corporation. And essentially what he argued is that in a free market, corporations would still exist. Obviously, the way corporations exist right now, you get special privileges from the government. But he argues that in the absence of that, we would still have corporations just the way people would voluntarily get together and arrange contracts. So that's be on the lookout for that in a few months. I think you'll find that really interesting. I think I, like many people for a long time, thought corporations were evil. I really, really wanted to find common ground with the left, and this seemed to be the area where, okay, we can all denounce corporations. But the more I researched, the more I realized they're clearly wrong in this. I don't know if you guys heard, Elizabeth Warren is trying to pass an Accountable Capitalism Act, which essentially would have nationalized every single firm that earns over $1 billion in revenue per year. Kind of like what the Nazis did, just saying. So I don't really believe the left on corporations anymore, so I'm writing a book about that. As far as my show, I host the Peace and Liberty podcast. You can find me at forpeaceandliberty.com. I'm actually going to put out an episode tonight. It's going to be about the birth of Austrian economics, so you'll like that episode. Working on a bunch of other episodes, but I hope to put out about 2 to 3 episodes a week from now on. I started a college semester tomorrow, so it's been pretty rough. But yeah, just working on a lot.
Yeah, right on, man. And that's awesome. You know, before we really get into things, we have you guys announced that we do have a podcast feed now for our State of the Libertarian Union talk shows? And I think Daniel knows the most about that. Are you there with us?
I do know a fair amount about it. You can find it at libertarianunion.com, but it is hosted at anchor.fm/libertarianunion, and it is our State of Libertarian Union talk shows, which we've been doing monthly. This is, I think, number 9, and so you'll find that in the feed. And just so you guys are aware, it's actually getting a fair amount of listeners. So it's doing great.
Right on. Yeah. Well, I'm so glad, you know, we got a whole bunch of busy beavers here doing the libertarian stuff. So what's going on in the world? You know, I mean, we have the Talib Kweli'd or whatever his name is drama going on. I think we better touch on that. But
you know, something's really screwy about that guy's Twitter account. And Tom pointed this out yesterday. The guy gets like 10, 15 likes on his tweets, but he has like a million followers. Something's a bit screwy about that.
Right.
No, that's normal.
Yeah.
That's how opposition accounts are. They paid for them.
Right. Well, either that or I think, you know, maybe a lot of his fans are just completely disinterested in this kind of topic. So they're just, you know, maybe they just followed because they like his music. I don't know. That's just a theory.
Well, the newest news is that Nicholas Sarwark tweeted this morning about Tlaib. Not really saying anything about it, just tweeting a song. Obviously, this is a jab at Eric July and Tom Woods and all those people. Just anything it can do to be in opposition to Tom Woods and the Mises Caucus, even if that means supporting someone like Tlaib.
Are you telling me that the guy with pictures of Mike Shipley arm in arm with him said something nice about leftist ideas? I don't know if I can believe that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just like, and the drama never ends with Sarwark. I think he likes it like that. He likes the party being super, you know, at odds with each other, people going to war. That's why recently we're trying to get the socialists out of the Libertarian Party. By the way, the Libertarian Party Socialist Caucus, they're not actually trying to do anything. They're there to cause trouble. And that's been pretty obvious from the start. They don't really have any ideas.
Well, that's not entirely true.
Well, what arguments Matt have they presented?
Matt is going to be on RT next week talking about libertarianism.
Who?
What's that?
Who?
Matt Kuhnel. He has a segment apparently next week where he's going to be talking about American libertarianism on RT today or whatever it is.
Well, the funny thing about Matt Kuhnel, that guy has me like forever blocked and for a reason. I was having a debate with him once. I was just like, you know, Matt, let me recommend some books to you. I recommend Mutual Aid in the Welfare State by David Beto. And this is what he said. He said, I'm really not a book reader. I learn through communication. So what does it mean when a leftist say they learn through communication? It means they learn from their other leftist friends who also don't read.
Or
so
from memes.
What I mean by they don't have any ideas is that they have no backing for anything they say. They know rent is theft. They think property is theft. They don't have any backing for that. They might be able to say, oh, Kropotkin said this, but they don't really know. So my personal view is they're just there to be disruptive. And point being, a measure was trying to pass recently to like evict the Socialist Party, and Sarwark voted against it. Sarwark thinks they, you know, you can definitely be a libertarian if
well,
you believe property stuff.
That's not actually the really important part about that, though, Stephen. The important part about Sarwark voting is that he voted at all. When the president has no obligation to vote, and in general, Sarwark has usually not voted on anything. But this one, in particular, he felt a need to vote against. It was so important that he had to step in and make sure his vote was heard.
Well, I think the position he tries to put us in is, you know, sure, libertarians say, we're not against communist societies. You can have your communist society over here, and we'll have a libertarian society over here. We do say that, but then we're talking about the Libertarian Party. What do libertarians actually believe? And their only argument is that the foundation of the word libertarian was originally tied to socialists. I mean, so what? I think the first ideas are sometimes terrible. They need to be worked on. I don't think just because something is like the first idea, the first instance of something, it's like that has to be the right one. I don't believe that.
But he can run a good meeting. So that's why we should vote for Sarwark again.
That's the only argument Cyborg has. It's like, oh, I'm a good marketer. I can set up events.
Yeah.
And he was pointing out.
I realize that we do not like Cyborg, but the fact of the matter is that there are things that he's very good at.
Yeah. I get that.
Aside from holding a meeting, like, for whatever reason, the pragmatists seem to think he's good at uniting the party, other than all of us, you know, propertarians or racists. Now, I don't know, are any of you guys familiar with Ryan Ramsey of the Libertarian Heathen?
No.
Nope.
Ryan actually, and this, I guess, gets the tinfoil hat weeds of the party. He believes 100% that Nick is COINTELPRO. He is, in fact, put there by the government for counter-opposition to the movement.
I mean, he sure does a lot of things that would make that theory plausible. It's not as if we hear that. It's just like, oh, there's no way that's true. There's no way that's true. I mean, there is some kind of plausibility to that. I mean, he especially considering he's thought to unite people. I mean, he obviously does the exact opposite of that. He's very divisive in many ways. And to people like Tom Woods.
Steven, you're a racist.
I know. I live with it every day, man. It's just,
me too. Hey, little black girl.
So I don't know. That's been the party drama lately. It's kind of just a reemergence of what happened last September and just like never ends. Sarvik's just going to.
Well, I have an even a more important question. Should I move to wearing a dashiki for everyday events?
I guess that's your answer, huh?
I think that was a solid yes. Like, that's what I need to do.
Oh my god.
I'm gonna play devil's advocate sort of here, even though not really. I want to call up. How do we think that Tom Woods and Eric July actually did as far as? Do we feel like they did anything? Like, you have this big leftist. Do you feel like they actually did anything to convert people with the way in which they carried that Twitter battle?
I don't think anyone wins from that kind of exchange. And, like, I really understand why Tom did it, because, you know, it's an opportunity for him to capitalize.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for selling Liberty Classroom. So I guess success would be measured by how many sales he made, because I don't think he converted anyone in that exchange.
I mean, Twitter's like the worst place to have debates, because you're limited to like, what, 140 characters? Like, how much information can you really cram into 140 characters to like convince your opponent? You really can't. So
isn't it 280 now?
Oh, is it 280? I don't know.
It's been doubled, I think. Yeah.
They not doubled much. At some point.
I find them really hard to follow because it's spiderwebs so quickly.
Right.
And different people are chiming in, and then it hives off into little different corners. And the way that Tlaib was responding, he doesn't like reply to people. He like copy and paste or something weird, so it doesn't even flow like a normal conversation or normal Twitter, which I find hard enough to follow. But I think that Tom did fairly well, because he was basically just pointing out Tlaib's kind of inconsistency, and Tlaib's only response was, "You're a racist." Well, any normal person's going to read that and go like, "Okay, that's your record's skipping here. You're doing that for 12 hours straight. You're not making an argument." And I think Tom did fairly well. I don't know if it's going to convert anyone who's already a progressive, but I think anyone who's intellectually honest will come to the conclusion that Tlaib's just full of shit.
I think it's probably like it would have rallied the base of libertarians, basically. So it probably looks good on that part. But people who agree with him, who agree with Tlaib, probably don't really. Either they don't follow it at all, or they're probably not confirmed. But I'm not sure.
Well, I was going to say that sadly, a normal person would probably look at that and be like, "Yep, Tom's a racist." You know, I mean, with the state of things being the way they are, regular people would just read that and yeah. Just agree with Tlaib.
I think the July exchanges are the more interesting.
Well, if it's any consolation, I think that July's badass. I mean, July used to be a blood, and he's like, "Okay, well, I'll beat you on the debate stage, or if you don't like that, we can walk into the ring and I'll beat your fucking ass, man."
On another note, there was a picture Tlaib took with this guy named Louis Farrakhan. I'm not actually familiar
Louis
with that
Farrakhan.
Guy. Louis Farrakhan, okay. Well, I noticed one of the comments on the tweet, because Tlaib had a picture of him with
He's
his arm around the guy.
Of Islam, I believe.
Yeah, and one of the comments said, "Oh, why are you posing with the guy that like supposedly helped assassinate MLK, Martin Luther King?" And so, like, you can't win. You can't win.
You know who the Nation of Islam is, correct?
Yeah.
Ideologically, it's the alt-right for black people.
Damn, yeah, well, do we have, is there anything else going on? I did hear on Dave Smith's show that apparently Rand Paul has the ear of Donald Trump. Did you guys listen to the latest part of the problem?
I did. What, Donald Trump? I don't know how much that matters, though.
Yeah.
I mean, has he stopped a war yet?
Well, possibly. So the whole point was is that, well, apparently Rand Paul has the ear of Trump, and Rand has convinced Trump that it is not a good idea to go to war with Iran. Did you guys hear
Believe
that?
Leave it when or... I see it.
Well,
Remove
yeah.
them sanctions.
Same. But, yeah, I agree. You got to remove them sanctions. And I don't know. It's a little glimmer of hope on the horizon, at the very least, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. The thing about Rand Paul, I know he definitely doesn't want to be a spitting image of his father. Like, I think he actually hates when people compare him to his father. So on that note, I think Ron Paul was a little bit more hesitant to work with everybody in Congress, you know, work together, man, find like a good tax measure that we should all pass. No, Ron, you voted against taxes. I think with Rand Paul, he's much more willing to work with people, like compromise in that sense. And I think that's the big difference. I like Rand Paul. Every other day I love him, and then every other day I hate him. It never ends.
Well, I laughed when you said that, because I met Rand Paul at Freedom Fest in 2014, and I shook his hand, and I didn't know what to say. I kind of went up to him, and I was like, "Hey, Rand, I'm a big fan of you and your dad. Will you shake my hand?"
That's exactly how I felt at the Mises Institute. Like, Tom Woods, we're all good friends, but just like when you meet people in person, it's like, oh, man, like, what do I say?
Right.
What do I say? Yeah. It's like you have a million questions you have to ask in the back of your mind, but it's just you go blank when you're in the presence of your mentors. Yeah.
And then totally well, I met Robert Murphy, and kudos, Bob Murphy. He was so fucking nice. And this was before I really knew the whole thing, because it was back in 2014. But he was so nice, man. I love Bob Murphy.
So nice. And, you know, the thing about those guys is they all are weirded out that people like obsess over them, because they just feel like normal guys. Like, I'm just an economist. And Bob Murphy always talks about, like, you know, some of you guys come up to me and, like, you're, like, shaking. Like, you know, it's okay. Just come ask to take a picture. It's okay. You know, we were all economics nerds in high school.
Right, yeah.
I'll be honest. He emailed me back the other day, and I was very surprised by it.
What'd you ask him?
We'll get to that at some point. We'll see what happens.
Well, one of the best parts of being in the Liberty community is that, like, all of our heroes per se are just normal dudes, and they're really accessible. Like, I mean, I mailed Stefan Kinsella a couple months ago to bounce some paper ideas off of him, and he was like, "Oh yeah, yeah, you know, here's all these sources you'll have to check out and all these links, you know," and it felt really cool, really cool. Dice, have you had any interactions with you know, the Mount Rushmore of libertarianism?
Oh, I've in the south of the country. David Friedman actually came there, so I did take a selfie with him. It's quite fun, but most people, of the big ones they stay on the other side of the Atlantic. But yeah, it was quite cool to.
I still want to order and read The Machinery of Freedom. I've heard that's his most popular book. I'm kind of confused. Yeah, yeah. About his utilitarianism version of anarcho-capitalism. I'll be honest, I don't really know much about David Friedman. I know he was Milton's son. I know he's an anarcho-capitalist in the utilitarian side, but I don't even know what that means. But what is a utilitarian anarcho-capitalist?
Well, thing? You know, I really agree with him, actually, and I've adopted his theory of how, like, free market arbitration would work. I think the major point is just that in an anarcho-capitalist society, if there is no entity that has a monopoly on, you know, the initiation of force, then they would by necessity have to be libertarian. It's not that they have to embody libertarian principles, but they would have to by necessity, because otherwise enforcing things that would violate the NAP would be prohibitively expensive. But that's the only, yeah, that's the only thing that I remember that stuck in my craw from it.
I know he did a debate with Bob Murphy once, and David Freeman argued for the position of the Chicago school, and Bob Murphy argued for the Austrian school. And basically, I remember David Freeman ended by saying, the reason I'm a Chicago school economist is because I believe in going out and doing research and like drawing conclusions from that. I mean, as if Austrian economists don't do research and draw conclusions. That's ridiculous. That's a complete misnomer.
Right. And I remember at that stage in my, you know, looking into, and I was really trying to test and like find critiques of Austrian economics. And I remember viewing that debate, and I wasn't entirely convinced by Bob Murphy, you know, against empiricism, but I kind of get it now. We should put a link to that debate in the show notes because it was a good one, I think.
Yeah, I think especially for Bob's position, it takes more than 5 minutes to explain it. That's just the truth. It takes a little bit of time to like really, really, really get to the root of it. Whereas, you know, maybe David Freeman could propose his view in like a minute. But I think the Austrian school, it takes a little time to understand it. It's not everything's so clear because you kind of have to undo a lot of what you're taught to think. That's the hardest part.
Well, and go ahead, Thijs.
Yeah, with the utilitarianism, I guess I read it, but it was quite a while back. But from what I've read, it's sort of his argument seems to be that if you have like this sort of market stateless society, then you can't law itself will be contractual, and you don't have something like natural law. And yeah, like Rothbard thinks that sort of law itself will be the same everywhere, and that's just universally binding. And
utilitarians argue that the best result is the one that benefits the most amount of people. It doesn't really matter the means, but it's what benefits the most amount of people. So maybe David Freeman would argue, or excuse me, maybe an Austrian libertarian would argue that the reason we should have a free market society is on principle. Whereas the utilitarian would argue like this would benefit the most people if we had a free market. So I think that's probably the big difference. I might be wrong. I don't know.
Right. No, that's what I was trying to get at, too, is that, you know, it's not that there has to be, I think by his point, it's not that there has to be per se a culture that would emulate, you know, our principled natural rights values. It's just that, you know, if everyone rejects this monopoly on force, naturally, this would be the result, you know, without some kind of principled moral stance or position.
Well, I think just the word benefits, I think that's a little bit subjective. If I'm given $100 by the government and another person's given $1,000, well, couldn't I argue that I'm not benefiting at all because that guy got, you know, nine times more?
Sure. Yeah, anyone else got something?
I know Daniel does.
Yeah, Daniel.
All right, so utilitarianism can be used to justify just about anything, which is kind of like my major beef with it.
Sure.
It's like saying that as long as we can measure it in a certain way and show a benefit and point to some graph or some result, then we can therefore be malleable in our principle. And I don't agree with that at all. The other thing is it's a little bit of cart before a horse. If you think that you can run a study and then try to divine some theory from the tea leaves, you can basically see whatever you want to see. I mean, how many times can you refute a study with another study or my expert versus your expert? You never really get anywhere. I think you'd really need to have core first principles to build from. And then you can use measurements and testable, you know, hypotheses and things like that to support the theory that you're proposing. So if anything, they help create the thought.
The way in which you worded that, I kind of have to disagree. I understand your point on it. However, what's really changed is what the first principles are. With libertarianism, anarcho-capitalism, you have a system that you believe is the first principle, that there's an ethical way to act. Action is obviously the key to the entire libertarianism thing. When it gets into utilitarianism, I believe they would simply say that human life itself has some type of value, in that basically, the more bodies you stack in one way or the other determines if it is a good or a bad action. The actual goodness, or that human life itself, is how they're determining what it is. It's not the action having some type of ethical backing. Now, we would all look at that and say, you know, well, the action is the important part. Human life is what it is. But they do have a point in that. I mean, if an action is going to wipe out a million people versus one, there is some kind of clear-cut answer to that problem. Like, you probably should take out the one person versus a million.
Well, I think utilitarians could end up on the deontological Austro-libertarian viewpoint if they could show that utilitarianism, or what benefited the most people, was a free market. My problem with utilitarianism is if they run through, they go through some data and they find that, okay, a free market, you'll do pretty good, but you know, if we have like 10% government, that will be infinitely better. I disagree with that. I don't care if the numbers say that at all. On principle, I think people should be free. So it's kind of like, I don't even care what the test results say.
Well, and the other thing that if you really want to point at the utilitarians where they'll have an issue is that you would have to be able to empirically define what is good for the most people, and that may require
looking
very, very far down into the future. There's no way to empirically prove that.
It's kind of like what if you give 100 people townhouses, but they all wanted single family homes? Well, whoops.
Yeah.
That's the whole problem with like redistributing houses. How are you going to do it? You're going to have to immediately discriminate. You're going to have to say, okay, rationally, maybe like a mother with three kids would get the single family house. Maybe single 18-year-old would get an apartment. But there's no real way to do it without discriminating. At some point, like, you're giving some people mansions. You're giving some people really tiny, crappy houses just to give somebody a house. In that scenario, people aren't going to be as happy as you think they are, because they're going to look at the person that was giving something more. Now, another thing about human action, it's a priori. We know humans act independent of experience, because just by me saying that humans don't act, I act by doing that. So it's self-contradictory to say humans don't act. So Austrian economists would argue that you need to operate off a self-evident axiom and then go from there. You can't say, okay, I think the world works this way. Let me go find the formula that fits that. No, you can't really do that. Another big problem is falsification, and even Hayek fell into this trap. You know, the idea that for an idea to exist, it has to be falsifiable, otherwise it's just nothing. Well, the idea that humans act is unfalsifiable. It is an unfalsifiable position. So, I don't know. You guys can discuss that.
Yeah, well, let me throw this one at you, Stephen, because I don't necessarily think that the natural rights position, like, so if we're getting into utilitarianism, I kind of think that at the first two chapters of A Theory of Socialism and Capitalism by Hoppe, he kind of sets out his idea of where rights come from, and I don't think it necessarily contradicts the Lockean natural rights position, because we would say that would be more natural rights, and I think that Hoppe's position is utilitarian, because his whole justification for the idea of rights is that, well, we need to figure out what to do with scarce resources, because scarcity exists. Even in the Garden of Eden, scarcity exists. And the reason why we need property rights is because we have to determine, you know, what is the most efficient way and firm way to predict, you know, whose property is what. And I really think that that's more of a utilitarian argument as opposed to the Lockean natural rights. And then, you know, Kinsella takes that and injects his estoppel theory. But I really don't think the two contradict each other. What do you think?
Well, one thing Hayek is, because Hayek diverged from Mises in many ways, one being that he thought natural rights was based on evolution, so natural rights evolved. Now, here's a question. Did people have natural rights in, let's say, 1 AD? Or let's say 3000 BC, did they have natural rights back then, even if they weren't aware of them? I would argue yes. I would argue everyone always had natural rights. It's just a matter of recognizing it and putting into practice measures that would fit that. So the question is, have natural rights always existed? Have they evolved through our mental faculties being increased. I don't know. My personal opinion is natural rights always existed, but that is the other argument, that natural rights, they're not innate. They just kind of evolve over time. And okay, at the point where we are now, 2018, a lot of people recognize that murder's wrong, stealing property's wrong. That may not necessarily have been the case in 3000 BC, and it probably wasn't. But it's just a matter of, did those natural rights exist prior to understanding them? That's the debate.
I would say, well, they don't. Sorry, Nick.
There you go.
I would say that they didn't exist prior to people understanding them, because that Hoppe kind of explains that, you know, the reason why animals don't have natural rights is because they're utterly incapable of recognizing the property rights of others. So I would say maybe it did evolve, you know, maybe Hayek's right that it did evolve, but there's no one point at which, boom, you know, people had natural rights. It'd be at whatever point they sat down as a society and decided, you know, okay, we're going to have the system of property arrangement where we recognize, you know, homesteading and all that good stuff. So sorry about that, Nick.
Well, I think natural rights, I mean, I think it's a philosophy for humans. I don't think it's a philosophy for whales or cockroaches or right. sea urchins. I think it's a philosophy for humans. So I don't know if you can apply that to animals and say, okay, animals can't consciously think about property rights, so property rights don't exist. I think natural rights is a philosophy for humans. So, well, go ahead, Nick. We're cutting
all
off.
All right. Yeah,
sorry.
So let's get racist on this. Is that what we'll call it?
Sure.
That's how libertarians like it.
I can tell you that some of those values that, you know, you've espoused as being natural rights are not universal. They just aren't. Here's a question I want to take this to, is that where do we as libertarians take that as far as, I think this starts getting into the Hoppian stuff. We have a Western belief in these things, but if you do go over to Africa, these are not necessarily ideals that are espoused by every culture over there. Theft is kind of its own thing in a lot of places over there.
I think it's kind of an objective test. Like, if are you capable of understanding and respecting property rights? Not do you, but are you capable of it?
Well, I think you've read The Enterprise of Law, but remember, like, in the first few chapters, he's talking about that primitive type of society. It's actually recent. This is a primitive type of society, and they all pretty much had property rights. And that's so there's the myth that, or I think Walter Block's actually working on a paper, and I really want to read it, but he's not done. And it argues that man is naturally socialist, meaning, you know, we're born into tribes, and we all have to kind of collectively share stuff because we don't have the productive means to live as individuals outside of a group. And that does seem plausible. So what he'd argue is that we're naturally socialists, and as our mental faculties increase and, you know, our brains grew, we were able to then understand individualism and actually have the potential to go out and be individuals outside of the group. Like, I'm in my apartment right now. I don't live with the tribe right now. And that's possible because of property rights and because of things like that. So what do you think about that? Because I know you've read The Enterprise of Law, and that book's blowing my mind, by the way.
I'm telling everyone that's the book to read, man. And
I got it for free at the Mises Institute. It was a free book. I got home, and I'm just like, oh my god, what a gold mine.
Oh yeah, I mean, Benson is fucking awesome. But what was it? Can you rephrase your question?
So the idea is that I don't think it's necessarily true that just because you live in a tribe, you can't have property rights, or you're too primitive, you can't understand property rights. I think you can. Maybe it'd be less likely.
Yeah.
That wasn't actually even my point.
Okay, yeah.
There are actually modern societies over there where things like theft are wholly considered different than they are here.
Right, right.
Like, I'm talking people that drive cars and have bodegas down the street.
I mean, it might just ultimately be the values that are inculcated in you as you're brought up. I mean, that was really not... Kids will believe almost anything. And that's the reason why Lenin said you need 20 years to have a communist revolution. You need to kill off all the adults, start everybody over from babies, and raise them up to believe what you want them to believe. Adults are set in their ways. That's just known. Like, you take any old grandmother, they probably use the same mixer from 1920. I mean, they're set in their ways. It's just kind of a fact of old people.
They're all racist, too.
Well, and that specific tribe that you're talking about, I think it's in New Guinea. And I forget their name. I did an episode on it, but it's not. It was like a primer, non-state justice systems, a primer, like episode 36, libertyweekly.net/36. But it is surprising to me that, you know, despite the fact that they've developed property rights and like this customary legal system without any kind of coercive enforcement mechanisms, they still have not advanced beyond Stone Age technology. So
yeah,
it's a weird quandary, you know?
Yeah, I think absolutely. In most cases of tribes, they're gonna have that kind of socialist, like share stuff, and like nobody really owns things. Just let me borrow the hairbrush now or whatever. I imagine in most tribes it's like that, but I was really surprised to at least see one example where, okay, they're primitive, but they've evolved much more than a lot of modern societies, haven't they? Even despite their non-access to outside.
Yeah, right. Thijs, you've read this too, right?
Yeah, I'm on chapter one right now, I think. And I think definitely natural rights, natural law. I think the point with the universality is more like people are universally capable of reading this. They are capable of recognizing that these rights exist, and they if they don't do that, then it's bound to result in less prosperity and less peace and so on. And yeah, with the animal stuff, I bought this book a while back. I also want to read it, but I keep postponing it. But that's it's like a former Randian sort of objectivist, I think, and he wrote a book called Why We Are Nature's Favorite, and he sort of compares animals to humans, and basically why humans have rights and animals don't, and with the principal position on that. So that's also kind of an interesting one.
Sounds like a whole lot of gobbledygook when you could just say Jesus.
Oh my God, you're right, Nick.
Yeah.
I think animals can be property. I just don't think they can have natural rights.
Right. I would agree. And well, I think this kind of gets into the question about the New Guinea tribes. I think Jeff Deist answered this on Tom Wood's show. I don't know, in the last two episodes, but
that was a good episode.
It was great. I always love when Jeff Deist comes on. But he was saying that, you know, it would be foolish to assume that the libertarian solution to everything is perfect, and that the solution is to privatize it, because privatization, you know, is one prerequisite maybe for a prosperous and peaceful society. So, you know, with the example of the tribes in Papua New Guinea, you know, or just New Guinea in general, but it'd be folly to assume that, you know, free markets and property rights is the only prerequisite to having a prosperous society.
Yeah, it just goes along you know, nobody can plan society, not even libertarians. Libertarians don't have the right answer per se. We deduce what we think is right, but in general, what is right and wrong is totally subjective.
Well, not to get off topic, but I think this is a really important thing to discuss. Are all libertarians like terrible at pronouncing things?
I am.
I've heard at least three or four things so far in the course of this show that I'm like, really? You don't know how to pronounce that?
Is it Papua New Guinea?
Maybe of us should put down some books and listen to some conversations.
Papua New Guinea, that's like the Papa patch, right? You know that child song?
Papa.
It's Papa?
Papa New Guinea.
Oh, yes. Shit. I always mispronounce things, so.
I just suck at pronunciation in general. I don't know.
you autistic libertarians.
All right.
Yeah, that's probably not. Patrol. That's what my girl's like right now.
What's that?
Just for the record, Bob Murphy, in his reply to me, did call me out for my joke about autism.
Oh, really?
What'd he say?
I don't remember the exact wording, but I made a joke about, like, you know, the show being about proving libertarians aren't all autists. And the first thing out of his mouth is, I just want to go on record as saying that autism is a real thing. And I was like, oh, God damn it, Bob, you're such a sweetheart.
He is, and he's a real strong Christian. I'm Christian, too, so I can connect with Bob like that. And I just try to be good people, you know. Be nice to people. I don't know, something like that.
He was probably.
I had to reply. Liz's brother is has Asperger's, so I do know it very well.
Oh yeah, if you have a family member that has a disability, it definitely hits closer to home. Sure.
Well, let's move away a little bit from the highbrow shit. Yeah. What are you guys doing like this summer? I mean, have you taken any vacations or trips or anything?
I'm worried about next summer, bro.
Working all summer?
Well, I've got like 3 jobs, so yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We need to have a libertarian union live on the beach one day.
No, we do.
Well, we're already talking about that.
Yeah?
The Wizards are trying to set it up, man.
I usually go to Miami Beach once or twice a year, so I'll meet you guys in Miami Beach if you want to do it there, man.
I mean, you're not going to get me to a beach, but...
Oh, come on.
I burst into flame. I'm sorry.
Contra Cruise. 2019.
Oh, man. Too many libertarians on a boat? That thing's right to get sunk.
Okay, here's a good debate. Does sunscreen cause cancer?
I've heard that. I don't know.
Yeah, I'd be curious to hear about that. I don't go in the sun. I stay inside until it's dark, but...
I was tanned for 1 year in my life. I was 16 and I was a lifeguard. I've been pale ever since.
Everything causes cancer. That's the answer. That's the
answer. I mean, people are like drinking soda causes cancer. Yeah. Using cell phones causes ear cancer. I mean, everything causes cancer. I'm happy to get cancer.
There's this show on Netflix. What was it? We were watching it last night. What is it called, honey? Afflicted. And it's all these people that have like these made up diseases and their lives are just ruined. Like one lady, she can't be around Wi-Fi or... It's called electromagnetic sensitivity. And you can just tell that she's making the whole thing up. And her
husband... That's kind of like Chuck in Better Call Saul.
Right. Oh, I haven't seen that, but...
That's exactly what he has. He has this thing where he thinks electricity harms him, so his whole house is... There's no lights in his house. Can't be in your cell phones. If you're in a room with him, like, you can't be in an electronic room.
Whoa! Now...
No, that's Better Call Saul. It's a good show.
Scientific side of this, I mean, if sunlight has the ability to harm you, technically any type of radio frequency, which is all the same spectrum of the same thing, also has the potential.
Okay,
since day one been a criticism of cell phones and all the modern technology we have, that it does run the risk of causing cancer.
I think to some extent, yeah, and I read recently, I think it's AT&T, they were setting up cell towers with 5G. And there's reports that a lot of the people working on that like have cancer now. It makes sense. Like if you're right next to radiation, yes, that can give you cancer. I think it's a matter of like, can using a cell phone like 5 hours a day give you ear cancer? That's the debate. I do think there's something to that, of course.
Maybe 5G is the global depopulation, like the catalyst that causes the global depopulation and ushers in the new world order, and we're all gonna live on the prison planet in Alex Jones FEMA camps. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
all of us who are immune to the electromagnetic frequencies, we're all going to live in the FEMA camps, and that's the end game.
That's another debate. So flat earthers argue that gravity doesn't exist. They argue that we live in an electromagnetic world, and like the reason we stick to the ground is because of electromagneticism.
Are you a flat earther?
No, I'm just putting the arguments on the table.
I mean, you're a Christian, so already I've got my questions about the believability of what you say. I mean, you guys believed in an ark with a bunch of animals and stuff.
I think the stories in the Bible were fables. I think there were fables that you could draw messages from them and create like a moral compass for that.
But Christian,
I mean, I don't think you have to be a word by word literalist for to be a Christian. I mean, I call myself a Christian, but maybe I should just call myself spiritual.
Hold on.
You just say you listen to Jordan Peterson.
Love Jordan Peterson. I don't think he even calls himself a Christian. He's just someone that.
No, he does.
Well, it's weird.
But it's always
because...
funny because he has the an anthropologic appreciation for Christianity and looks at it through a historic perspective, which was kind of like the nail in the coffin to my Catholicism.
I mean, I think Jordan Peterson's kind of in line with what I believe that. You know, you don't have to believe that Noah's Ark can exist, but can you draw lessons from that can make for a better life? And the Ten Commandments, I think a lot of the Ten Commandments are good. Don't steal. Don't murder. Don't covet. That's another big one that leftists never like to talk about. When they say Jesus is a socialist, they never talk about what it means that thou shalt not covet. Covet means to be jealous of what others have around you. That's what coveting means, and that's a sin. That's one of the Ten Commandments. So I think there's things you can draw from Christianity that apply to libertarianism. But no, I'm not a word-for-word literalist when it comes to the Bible. I've never been. I was in a private Christian school when I was kindergarten to fifth grade, and even back then I kind of sensed that, okay, I get what this is saying, but do we really have to argue about whether this happened? Or I look past that.
Well, you know what? There is actual scientific evidence that in 1300 AD, nope, it was BC. It was like 10,000 BC. I'm serious. A comet hit the Earth. This is Graham Hancock here. The whole, like, there's a lost chapter in human history regarding, like, an ancient civilization that no one knows about, that a comet really did hit the Earth in, like, 13,000 BC, and it flooded a shitload of everything, and that's where all the flood stories come from all across, you know,
antiquity. And the craziest thing about that is essentially when that meteor hit, it kind of set the Earth on fire, because what happened is that immediate explosion so powerful that it kind of like shoots everything back out into the sky and just like rains like a meteor shower of fire. So yeah, I would suggest this one guy. He's been on Joe Rogan many times. This guy's name is Randall Carlson. What a freaking genius, man. Like Joe Rogan does 3-hour podcasts, right? But this is one where like I'll sit through and listen to for 3 hours to this guy. Randall Carlson, write that guy down. He's incredible.
I'm going to have to watch that shit.
Yeah, Randall Carlson. And essentially what he argues, I don't think he's... I think he understands the global warming argument. What he argues is that, look, we can look to the past, and there's been such devastating things that have happened to the Earth. You really, really think driving cars is going to exacerbate what has happened in the past? You really need to look in the past and like look at what happened. Like the Earth has alternated temperature so much. So yeah, Randall Carlson just totally blew my mind, because when you listen to him, he doesn't sound like he's anti global warming. I'm sure he understands that. But what he argues is that, look, there's been so many variations in the past. How are you really going to say that what we do now is really, really what's going to launch us into the stratosphere? I don't know.
That's actually one of the arguments I get from Jason Stapleton that I do like. And this is also, I'm going to piggyback with another point. But who the hell are we to decide what the hell the optimum temperature of the planet is? We're at the end of a fucking ice age. Of course it's going to be getting hotter. Like, do we just get to determine that?
Oh, it's amazing. I was listening to Bill Nye once, and this is what he said. He said if the Industrial Revolution never happened, the temperature today would be the same as it was in 1700. He literally said that, and it's just like, Bill, you understand that climate changes with or without human activity. But he was saying that he said certainly that, you know, if we just didn't have the Industrial Revolution, temperatures would be the same as they were in 1700.
Like, all that said, I think that's a stupid way to approach the argument. When the easy way to approach the argument is, okay, cool, it's getting hotter, and well, let's start talking about the economics of how that affects the world around us.
You know, right, because without the Industrial Revolution, the population would still be the same as 1700, thereabouts.
I'm Bob Murphy, so I always go to on this one, because, you know, he gets into the economics of how fucking devastating to humanity it would be to follow the leftist models of dealing with it. I'd rather follow the capitalist model and wait for somebody to figure out how to fucking deal with the problems that it's caused.
And that's obviously the best question is, like, what temperature should the Earth be? No one ever answered that. The most they'll say is, like, what Bill and I said. Well, the temperature is the best that was about, like, 300 years ago. That was the best temperature. It doesn't even really make sense.
We have more reforestation going on now than at any point in, like, human history.
Right. All the people that are against, you know, chopping down the Amazon, they don't realize that, okay, if I'm in the business of cutting down trees, it might be in my best interest to, like, replant a tree so in 20 years I can come back and do it again, unless you're just in it for the booty for, like, one harvest. I mean, that's not really thinking long term.
Well, I've grown up in an area where logging is an actual industry. And don't get me wrong, you have shitty businessmen that go up and clear cut.
Was it in Washington or Oregon?
No, New York State.
Really?
Yes, but in the same vein, you also have good people that know, I go, I cut this wood, I pull the dead wood, and then I plant more trees, and they'll grow, and then there's a whole cycle that keeps it. So you'll always have trees to cut.
There's
good
a
business.
They have machines now that they're so complex, they do it all in once. They cut down the tree, you drive over the path, replant the seeds. Like, it does it all in one. That's what capitalism has been able to provide us. And I've read articles that say cold weather kills about 20 times more than heat.
No, I have trees like plants really like heat. Look at I can't remember exactly what they say the average temperature was like during the age of the dinosaurs, but you also look at the print of all of the plants that existed at that point, and it's insane.
I don't know how we got on this topic, by the way. This is interesting.
I think
well, the economics of climate change.
Okay. So
we should also post down below in the show notes the presentation that Murphy gave, because he actually uses the climate, I don't even know what you call them now, but the evangelical climate change people. He uses their starting points, their premises as his starting point, and still shows them that they're wrong.
Yeah, beautiful. No, that's exactly it. My favorite debate method is to concede from the beginning. Say, okay, so given that's true, here's where we go from there, and you're still wrong. Anytime anybody calls, Ron Paul, Tom Woods, or any of those guys racist, I'm like, okay, I'll give you. Sure, maybe they're racist, but does that make their ideas wrong in any other scope? No. It doesn't have a goddamn thing to do with it. Racist assholes can have good ideas too. I don't think they're racist, but it does mean no service to have to fight them at that level.
I mean, I think
actually get into the ideas.
I think funny enough, libertarians are against pollution, but that's from respect to property rights. So when you talk about
a huge environmentalist,
when you talk about like a corporation dumping stuff in a river, well, the reason that's happening is because the river's publicly owned. That's the problem. No one technically owns the river, so why not dump in it? Why not?
Dude, it's even worse than that. You see, you have the EPA, which sets standards, okay? Now, the minute you have the EPA, humanity goes on with its life believing that everything is being handled and they don't need to be concerned about it. Now, meanwhile, they set those fines. Now, fines go straight to the government, so there's a reason for them to collect fines. They set them just low enough to look like they're doing something about the problem, but not so high as to actually do damage to the company. Whereas if we could actually not have the EPA involved at all, people would actually pay attention and could have a lawsuit against any company, state them economically as a class action lawsuit. We'd have a far easier time getting rid of bad actors environmentally.
Absolutely. And I think they don't use those fines to clean up the messes. They would rather you just dump in the river so they can find you. I mean, it's just like, okay, we'll just charge you 10 grand. I doubt they take that 10 grand and fix the river. So,
no,
yeah.
Take it, pocket it.
Yeah. Good point. Good points, Nick.
No,
what do you want to say?
Well, honestly, I just get pissed off because I'm someone who, like, I grew up in the country and keeping the environment maintained is incredibly important to me. But, much like people assume I'm racist because of my political views, they also assume that I can't stand the fucking environment. And it's, I'm going to be honest.
Murray Rothbard wrote it.
Man, I'm a fucking tree hugger of the highest order.
Yeah, Murray Rothbard wrote a ton about pollution. You know, pollution is pollution. Like, you're violating property rights. If I'm walking up to you and like blowing smoke in your face, it's violating your property, right? Because you have the right to breathe. I know Walter Block even teaches a class. I think it's called environmental economics or something like that. So libertarians are pretty involved in environmentalism. It's just we're kind of shit out of the argument before we can make our point, because they're just like, okay, you want to dump in a river, end of story. And it's like, well, you know, hold on.
I've got a great Murray Rothbard lecture on that in the Economics 101 series. It's number 6 of 8, and that's on the Reed Rothbard YouTube channel, so we can post a link to that in the show notes down below as well.
Yeah, please do. I actually usually the first thing I do when I wake up in the morning, I wake up, I drive to the park, go read a chapter of a book, I come back home, then I listen to like a Murray Rothbard lecture, and then I go out about my day. So all those views in those videos don't know on me.
So this week I actually started on Audible my first Ayn Rand book. So I've been listening to him about, I think, 8 hours into The Fountainhead.
I've heard The Fountainhead too.
Rand?
I have most of Rand's books in my bookshelf. I have We the Living. I have Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged. I have a book called Capitalism. That book is basically just a collection of articles. It's funny enough, I made a post the other day because I didn't realize like Alan Greenspan used to be actually really good on stuff. You read his chapters in that book, Capitalism, the Ayn Rand book. It's great. He talks about the gold standard and all that good stuff. I think he got worse over time, obviously, but Alan Greenspan used to be okay. My favorite Ayn Rand piece, it's a short one, it's called Anthem. It's my absolute favorite. I love that one. I wouldn't suggest most people read Ayn Rand, because if you're already against her, you're going to hate her more. If you're skeptical about it, it's just like drilling the ideas in your head over and over. That's how Anne wrote. you just drill those ideas into your head over and over and over again. That's why you have like a few hundred pages of the John Galt speech. So I love Ayn Rand for what she did, but I think her
I was
reading.
Gonna say, I thought the Fountainhead was a fun story.
No, I think I've heard the Fountainhead's a really good one. Some people say they can't even make it through Atlas Shrugged. I'm the same way. I saw the movie series and it was terrible. It was terrible. Like the actors changed in like the second or third part.
Well,
and it was...
does that have more to do with the fact that it's absolutely gigantic? I think the Fountainhead is a 30-hour audiobook that I'm reading.
It's a big ass book, small
Atlas
print.
Shrugged was like over 100.
I think Ayn Rand was. She was a tough cookie, man.
And somebody was telling me that the Fountainhead is Malice's favorite, so I'm like, yeah, we got that now.
I think I personally have read Virtual Selfishness, quite interesting. It's a lot shorter, so basically more nonfiction. And I believe I've read Anthem as well. And to the bounce off the environmentalism thing. I think there's one article on Fee. It's called like 22 ways to think about environmentalism or about the environment or something. And that's like also a really good thorough exposure of the issue from everything from is the climate warming to what do we do about it, and if so, what if, and so on. Yeah.
Fancy.
Man, I read The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, or I read about 3/4 of it, and then I kind of got bored and put it down. But I don't know if that's because I have a short attention span, but...
I think Ayn Rand's life is more interesting than her books, to be honest. There's this one funny story where Ayn Rand was married to Frank O'Connor, but she was always with Nathaniel Brandon. Apparently, her and Nathaniel Brandon went up to Frank one day and was just like, okay, me and Nathaniel established a contract... and we're going to have an affair. And then, you know, I guess Frank just had to deal with it. You know, her life's just so funny. She just thought about things like that. Like, okay, you know, I'm going to sleep. I'm going to form a contract with Nathaniel Brandon and go have an affair with them and be back later. And of course the story, when Murray Rothbard was in the Ayn Rand cult for a little, like 6 months, I think he said, basically what happened is Nathaniel Brandon or Ayn Rand, they told Murray that you have to divorce your wife, Joanne, because she's a Christian. And usually the way Ayn Rand would go about it, she would try to talk to you at first, like give you some atheist material. And like, if you didn't convert, she was done with you. So she was telling Murray Rothbard to divorce his wife. And I think Murray told him to go to hell. You know, good riddance. Like, you asked me to divorce my wife because she's a Christian. Like, I don't even think Murray was a Christian. I think he really loved history and he loved reading about that stuff. So, you know, he loved his wife. The indispensable framework.
Yeah, I don't know. Religion's a weird thing. This doesn't really have much to do with anything as far as people acting their lives in a lot of cases. My wife's Christian and I am decidedly not.
That's all I've always thought about. It's just an individual, like, it's something you believe on an individual level. Like, I never go out in public and I'm like, oh, I'm Christian, by the way. What are you? Like, I never ever do that. I never talk about religion unless it's brought up.
Same. For some reason, I just don't find it religion to be very interesting in terms of like consuming content or podcasts.
Oh, you haven't read any Joseph Campbell then, my friend.
I haven't. I don't know. I just don't really find it interesting because I think it's all subjective.
And well, so I'm that's because you're reading the wrong stuff on it.
You need to read this book, Patrick. It's called The Secular Saints by Hunter Lewis. Really, really good book. And basically what he argues, the question is, can you derive a moral objectivity without God? It's pretty tough. That's basically what we argue. So The Secular Saints by Hunter Lewis. Really, really good book. You'll love that.
Right. I mean, personally, I was raised Lutheran, and I would still consider myself to be Lutheran. But I don't know. I kind of believe in that people identify God as being several different things. And
Martin Luther had a hell of a story, man. Wasn't his big thing that, like, he was out in a thunderstorm once, and, like, he told God, you know, like, if you don't strike me down right now, like, I'll convert. And, like, he didn't get struck down. He converted. Eventually had like his 99 theses. I forget a lot of it, but I learned about that. He had a crazy life.
Well, I mean,
he didn't have sex till like he was like in his 40s or 50. Like, he was older when he had sex, and supposedly they broke the bed. I just remember funny shit about him.
Oh my god. Well, I you know, barring any, like, I don't know Martin Luther that well, but I think he's a fucking badass. You know, just the very act of translating the Bible into the common tongue. I mean, that is such a monumental, like, achievement. You know, before
what was his main idea with Lutheranism? Because I don't really understand what the difference is.
Well, I
Catholic think, light.
Right. Well, I don't. Maybe I don't know enough about it to really debate you on that. But I think just his difference.
That's a Robin Williams joke, buddy.
Oh, is it? Well, his main point was just that, you know, before Martin Luther, people had to rely on the Catholic Church to interpret the Bible for them because it was written in Latin and people didn't understand it. And so and then they had to pay penance for their sins that they couldn't even really interpret or understand. So I thought that was really cool that he did that. But, you know, if someone could pull up like some terrible thing he did, I couldn't defend him against it or anything. But.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things is a lot of things get lost in translation. So, like, if it was translated to Latin, it had to be eventually been translated from Aramaic, the original language.
Right.
So,
So the church could control everything, you know.
And yeah. I do agree. Yeah.
But I was going to say I didn't mean to equate the moon as a harsh mistress with Ayn Rand because it's Robert Heinlein. But one thing I wanted to say was just that one with these philosophical fictional works, I just don't find them very interesting because I confronted the same problem when I was a creative writing major at the U of M. And that is that stories that are not character or plot driven or focus or not plot, but very character driven in a character struggle are just not interesting. And stories that try and make like a higher philosophical point, unless they have very strong characters and a very strong character struggle, they're just not very good. They're just not very interesting.
You're such a libertarian, bro. You want to cut the people out of the story about people.
Right. Well, in The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, I just didn't find the characters to be super compelling, you know? And I haven't read any of Ayn Rand's works, but I would imagine that would be, you know, a similar complaint that I might have with it. Because, you know,
I'm told that she's a very clunky writer.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen that yet.
I think her books were way longer than they needed to be, just as a general point. Like, cause she's like I said, she really, really beat you over the head with those ideas just over and over and over again. Like,
you got it the first time. A fucking audiobook, man. One book.
Well, and everyone assumes that because you're a libertarian, you've read The Fountainhead or like John Galt's Speech or something. And I honestly couldn't care less about Ayn Rand. I've never read a word.
She hated libertarians. You called them hippies of
exactly,
right.
And that's what I tell everyone is that Ayn Rand hated libertarians. And but I do say, you know, that I really think that everyone misunderstands what she meant by the virtue of selfishness. But
definitely,
I mean, that's all I could really say.
I think the main idea with that is like, do you believe in yourself? If you believe in yourself, that's selfishness. That's self-interest.
Right. So, yeah, I have a lot of friends who shit on Ayn Rand, and I'm just like, hey, I don't have a dog in the
game. Well, she was shitty at marketing for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, there was this one funny clip. If you're a watcher with Phil Donahue, there's this one lady in the audience, and she gets up and she asks a question. Her question's basically like this. You know, I was a big fan of your work, but I eventually kind of, and Ayn Rand stopped her right there. Just like, what are you doing? Like, why are you here? Why are you interrupting me on my show to ask me these stupid questions? Like, it was basically like that, just tore this woman apart. And all the woman was saying was just like, you know, I used to read your stuff. I used to like it. I've just kind of changed my mind a little bit since then. She just tore this woman apart. Like, why do you think it's okay to come on my show and do this? Like my show.
Well, that's notorious. She would just, if you don't like me, your opinion is worthless. Don't
and she would
about.
She would destroy you. I've heard that, like, you know, especially for libertarians, she would argue that you're essentially worse than communists, because at least communists, you know, they think they have objective morality, you know, communism is best. We're like, you libertarians, like, you believe in subjective theory of value. Like, I mean, you're like worse than communists. So that's what Ayn Rand would say. I mean, I really wouldn't want to be put in that position, like saying I'm a communist, but damn, that's what you would do.
Dude, we should talk about self-hating white people. Fucking
I'm not one.
did you guys follow the New York Times thing, the letter to the advice column thing?
I haven't completely been following that. What, say that again? Is it with that lady who's like the New York Times writer who's
Sarah
super
Jong.
Racist?
No, that's also an interesting story. But I think it was like someone wrote into the New York Times in a sort of an advice column, and it may or may not have been trolling, basically. But it was like, oh, I'm white, and I'm so terrified, and and I'm constantly taking up space that other people should have, and what should I do? And then they wrote this,
kill yourself
response. Yeah, sort of like, oh yeah, you really have to check your privilege. quite funny. Yeah.
Well,
I have not heard of that. I can look it up.
I just saw this post on Facebook just about, like, oh, how people are moving into these vans and, like, miniature houses to save the planet or something. Or people will say that the best thing you can do to help prevent global warming is to stop having children because, you know, if you have kids, then their carbon footprint will be so big or whatever. And I just...
The overpopulation right. crowd, they're totally insufferable. They don't understand that, like, population is down right now. Like, people need to have more kids right now. And there's something to that. Why do parents in poor countries have the most kids? Because they need their kids to support them.
Right.
That statement was actually inaccurate.
Which one?
Say that the population is down in Western countries.
Well, because sure.
Population is up, but we haven't actually stopped in any way the global growth of population.
It's down in the countries where we've been inculcated to think we're overpopulated. I mean, that's basically what they say, true. Is by 2100, man, the Earth's just going to be full. Like, it's not true.
Well, and that is so deeply rooted in fucking eugenics and, cannon fodder. Like, James Corbett has done, you know, that documentary Why Big Oil Conquered the World, and he talks about this summit that they had in Brazil in like the 1980s, talking about, they described people as being cannon fodder, and it was the global population bomb. They had all these dire predictions that of course were ridiculous and never came to pass, like that the world would be unsustainable by the year 2000, and it's all based in fucking eugenics.
Now, was that Malthus that was a big proponent of that? Malthusian?
You know, I'm really going to have to check that.
I might be screwing that up.
The Rome.
You
it
guys
had
need to think about this.
The Club of Rome.
They're still making those claims. I was actually, you know, I'm a big fan of Tim Pool, and he was talking about an article put out by, I believe, HSBC Bank recently that is genuinely concerned that humanity does not have the ability to sustain life. Like, if something were to happen, there's only enough resources available to last us like 9 months out of a year. Like, we're using up the resources. It was the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life, frankly.
Yeah, it doesn't really make sense.
but in his thing was, well, this is something that like a bank is saying, so you know, if the money is complaining about, you know, the bottom line, then we need to pay attention to it. My point is just that, so we still have people today in this day and age, knowing everything we know, that legitimately believe that the carrying capacity of the Earth has been, you know, permanently fucked.
I mean, I wonder if people notice why Alaska's called the last frontier. This is a big ass state, and most of it's uncharted territory. Like, you can go to Alaska right now and like be trekking through a completely new area because a lot of people haven't done it before. It's just so there's plenty of space in the world. I don't think that's the issue. I mean, it does seem plausible that, okay, you know, libertarians just know that scarcity exists. We live in a scarce world with scarce resources, but I don't know. How do you get – I don't know. Discussion. I am not a fan of the overpopulation crowd. They their arguments tend to be very weak, I think.
Well, I follow overpopulation in a sense that really dumb people procreate and smart people have a tendency not to.
Oh, sure. I could wish that some people didn't procreate. Yeah, absolutely.
And there's also the fact that they procreate more in places that don't have a historical belief in freedom.
Mm.
And then we import them.
I hear what you're saying, Hitler. I'm just kidding.
You know, this Tlaib guy did have it right when he said that Hitler got his ideas for eugenics from the United States, though. Like,
oh, absolutely.
It's not that...
Margaret Sanger and Planned Parenthood was a big supporter of eugenics.
Right, exactly.
I know that.
And, well, eugenics is fucking everywhere. I mean, if you've read the book Illiberal Reformers by Thomas C. Leonard, he's a Princeton lecturer. But, I mean, the entire progressive movement is just filled with eugenicists and people who...
Well, do you guys follow Thaddeus Russell at all?
Yeah, no. But, I know Thaddeus.
Thaddeus Russell, for a leftist, is definitely really good on some things. And one of his big points is literally like every war that's ever been started was started in academia by leftists. Like the justification for every single one, you can go back to Harvard and Columbia, and it's a bunch of egg-headed leftists that come up with the reasons for the war. But he, one of the things in particular, like that he gets into, is the whole beginnings of eugenics as a way to justify us going into World War II. That's how they got soldiers willing to kill people over there. They invented all of the why are we called Caucasians? It's based around the Caucasus Mountains over there. What are the Asian cultures? But the whole idea is it was started as an effort to get soldiers more able to kill. It's really
crazy. I mean, reading. They were like putting troops on like PCP, just like doing all this experimental shit. Like World War II is, oh my God. Hey guys, I got to go in about like 5 minutes-ish. Got to head out.
Yeah, well, I think we should close up anyways, because I think we're about an hour and 15 right now. So why don't we do a round table here? Patrick,
maybe we could do your book question that you put on social media, like the reading and what books are you reading and so on. And do you think should we change to get people to read? Maybe that one?
Yeah, that sounds good. I've been experimenting with social media, and I tried to play a hand from – I literally copied this question from Andrew Kern at the Principled Libertarian, because he's been so successful with all of his like interaction and stuff. And so I just posted a question of, you know, what books are you reading and why do you think that people don't read books anymore? I'm currently reading the Illiberal Reformers, and I just finished Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
And that's a good book.
I mean, fucking A, man. I mean, that's where it's at. And oddly enough, it really reflects Stoicism being one, and like a lot of Jordan Peterson's messages too, with, you know, like find meaning in your life and try and get everything in order and all that crap.
Well, so. I thought the main point of that book is that like no matter what someone takes away from you, they can't take away your own mind, your own determination of how you feel at that moment, and whether you're in a concentration camp or not, you can control your own mind. I think that's a very, very powerful idea. I mean, to be able to come out of the concentration camp and not just be full of hate and just hate the world. I mean, it seemed like it's kind of hard not to, but you do have control over your mind. They can't take away your mind.
Right. Exactly. And I found that message, you know, not unique, but in Stoicism, you know, because that's.
Did you read the whole book, by the way? Because I read about half of it. And I think the second part he talks about logotherapy, but I read the first half. That was this whole experience in the concentration camps.
Yeah. I read that half and I kind of got hung up on the logotherapy part, but I got to steam through it because, you know, I can't leave the book unfinished.
I can't. Got to. Finish the book, yeah.
Yeah, right.
I need to finish.
I was dating a guidance counselor when I read it. She bought it for me.
There you go. Well, why don't I'll just talk a little bit about Liberty Weekly, and then I'll hand it off to the next person to say their books. And I'm back. I'm waiting for my bar exam results. I get them on the 29th, so 9 days from now. I have a really, 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 really big guest appearance coming up with James Corbett, maybe in the next week or so. And so I'm super stoked on that. I'm excited to see where my numbers are going to go and my influence and reach. But so that's what's going on with me. I'd keep an eye out for that. I'll definitely republish it in my Liberty Weekly feed. Why don't we do Daniel next? If you're with us, buddy.
Daniel, the starter picture face.
All right. Well, phrasing for saying you're going to do me. regarding the books, I'm actually in the middle of several, and I seem to do this similarly with all the projects that I work on, the various websites and shows and everything, where I get a good idea or interest in one thing and start reading it at the expense of the other things, and before I know it, I've got like a dozen different things going at the same time. But I'm in the middle of three or four books. One is The Progressive Era, the most recent one that just came out from Murray Rothbard. Another one I'm in is The XYZ Socialism by Lawrence Reed, and I've got a link to that as a web page version from FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education, on our show notes page for our most recent episode on Office Space. So that's at actualanarchy.com/90. Another book I'm in the middle of, and this is related to our Rothbard Roundtable discussions with Matt, who's a big IP proponent,
is I'm reading Boldrin and Levine Against Intellectual Property, and they've got fairly utilitarian arguments and empirical arguments against intellectual property, patents, and copyright. And then I'm still also working my way through the 12 Rules for Life by Jordan Peterson. So
those are probably boring.
Yeah, it's like I could just read the table of contents and kind of get it. But anyway, it's still pretty good, and I still enjoy him. Other than that, I think we're still working on, Pat, and you can correct me on this or not, we're still working our way through Wild Wild Country. You know, we had a bit of a delay with travel from one of our guest hosts, and then Robert, my co-host, just moved as of yesterday. So
is he going to have internet now?
Yeah, he does have internet now.
Oh,
yeah,
my God.
He's made it all the way to having first world problems. So I think we should get into episode 5 of that sometime soon. And then just a little plug for our shows, Actual Anarchy and The Last Nighters. The next episode we're going to be doing is called Schooling the World, and that is going to have a guest with us, Jack B. Lloyd of the Voluntarist Comic, and also he runs The Honest Teacher. So that'll be a really good one worth checking out. And there's a link to be able to view that movie on our current show notes page for Office Space, which again is at actualanarchy.com/90. And go ahead and pass it over to Nick, your books and your final comments.
Well, I haven't read a book in probably, I don't know, like half a decade at least, but I listened to lots of them. Mostly it's just been random sales books lately, other than The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand. You know, working on that human capital thing. I've been doing a lot more blogging and just talking shit for SoundsLikeLibertyPodcast.com. I can't get into too much of what we got going on guest-wise, although I will say this week we have a graffiti artist down in Texas as a guest, which was pretty interesting. Moreover, that like he actually does graffiti art as a career and runs a business that way. So literally, I think you can make a business off of anything if you're intelligent about how you are going to, you know, make money on that.
Hey, guy made a pet rock.
The guy did make a pet rock. So well, yeah, why don't you take it there, Steven?
Yeah, and I gotta jump off right after I say this. So no point in really naming all the books I read. I probably read about like 100 books at a time. I mean, it kind of goes along with like my ADD. I have I'll pick up a book, read a chapter, put it down. I cannot read one book and just focus on the book for the week. So I end up just picking up about like 25, 50 books a day. I learn a lot in little increments, I guess you could say. But I honestly like want to work on my ADD. It honestly affects my life a lot, not being able to focus for long periods of time. It sucks. It does affect my life. But I'm reading, I just got this book in the mail. It's called The History of Money and Banking. I've been reading that, really, really good. I just got done with a book called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. That totally flipped my worldview upside down. I think from there, I'm going to have to like read some opposing viewpoints to that. But I never understood the history of Palestine. And like, wow, like, you know, the way the Palestinians were evicted, it was just gruesome. I'm reading a lot of books. If you ever wanted to ask me what books I'm reading, just ask me. But I'm reading so many. Going to put out an episode tonight. It's going to be about the birth of Austrian economics. So if you want to learn the names, that's going to be today's episode. The rest of the week, I'm going to focus on talking about what is Austrian economics. You know, interest, capital, all that stuff. So yeah, I'm focusing on Austrian economics this week. By the way, it was a pleasure doing the State of the Libertarian Union with you guys again. See you guys next month.
Peace, man. Thanks for joining us.
All right, see you guys.
And Thijs, what about you, buddy?
Yeah, so I'm also kind of on multiple books right now. I'm doing like 3 personal development books, and I'm also reading that Enterprise of Law right now. It's quite relevant, quite interesting, I think. But yeah, I'm kind of a procrastinator on that stuff. But so the other 3 are, let's see, 6 Pillars of Self-Esteem, The 7 Habits of Highly Successful and Effective People, and Habit Stacking. Those are 3 quite interesting books. And yeah, so I'm launching my own podcast/blog project soon, and I'm hoping to do it next week maybe, and will about be about 3 episodes and you can find me at gaiuslib.com or on social media on those names.
Excellent. Yeah. So once again, I'm Patrick McFarlane of the Liberty Weekly podcast. That can be found at libertyweekly.net. Got a lot of really cool things cooking up here for you guys, and really excited to share that interview with James Corbett with you guys. So you can find all of our work at libertarianunion.com, and you can find actually this audio feed in Daniel, I'm gonna ask you for the URL there. Is it anchor.fm/libertarianunion?
That is correct, sir.
Okay, excellent. So thanks for joining us for the month of August, and we'll be back hopefully soon with another edition of the State of the Libertarian Union talk show. Thank you, everybody.
You know, after a hard day burying my gold in an undisclosed tract of land somewhere in the rolling northeastern hills, nothing helps set my mind at ease about the impending societal collapse, quite like the fine podcast at the Libertarian Union. News and entertainment through an anarcho-capitalist lens lets me know I won't be alone. On that day when the normie hordes crest the hills into my little valley, and I'm forced to test the bounds of the non-aggression principle. So do yourself a favor and check out the Libertarian Union. Oh, and don't tell them who sent you.